House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. We are now in session. First up on our agenda this morning is a public hearing on House Bill 2948. I'm going to open that public hearing. And first up this morning, Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue, please.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Just a few administrative issues with the bill, sir, that I wanted to highlight for you. On page 1, line 7, the bill talks about total annual revenue of a corporation, and typically we deal with the revenues that are shown on a tax return. So we didn't know whether if a corporation is filing a short year return, for example, would they have to do a separate calculation to come up with total annual revenue, or are you thinking of that as the amount shown on the tax return? And if it is, then it might be reworded to say revenues shown on the return or gross receipts per the return. We do appreciate the fact that the bill gives us rulemaking authority, so there might be some of these issues that we could deal with by rule. Another item is it's also unclear exactly how this fits with the penalty provisions that are in current law. We would assume that a corporation deferring tax under this would not be subject to penalty for failure to pay the tax. If the corporation defers the tax and then the repayment period starts, would you want them then to be subject to penalties for failure to pay? And that's one thing that we might be able to do by rule. Probably our biggest concern from an administrative standpoint is with the interest rate that's used in the bill. This would require some programming for us to set this interest rate in our computer programming because it's different than what we use now. And it might be difficult for a company that's able to defer part of their tax, but not all of their tax. And they would have two separate interest calculations on the same return. A suggestion that we would make that you might want to consider is to use the standard rate that we have now, but provide for waiver of some percentage that would get you down to an equivalent to what you're using in the bill. And that might be 25% would be waived, 50% would be waived. That would bring down their total interest cost, but we would not then incur the cost to do the computer programming to reflect the language in the bill. And those are all my comments, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, anyone?
Is there any other testimony, Mr. Chair?
We have Mr. Sheketoff signed up, and I believe that's all that's signed up at this point anyways.
I would be very interested in getting with revenue and cleaning these points up.
Okay. Very good.
I will contact you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for volunteering, Representative Dahlem. Chuck, would you like to come up, please? Good morning.
Good morning. Chuck Sheketoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. My comments are very brief. I was concerned about line 14 on page 1 where it says the department may require the taxpayer to provide proof of eligibility. I think you should absolutely require it. It should be a shall. It wasn't clear to me whether this would be as limited to just in-state emerging businesses versus an out-of-state business that could need it. And then what about the other thing that's not clear for me is the interplay between this and the corporate minimum tax and other and tax credits and whatnot. So the first year a company could get a deferral. Can they? What if the next year they're paying the minimum tax? Should that shorten the deferral period or not? Because they basically would pay maybe more under this, and then the next year only $10. So those are my concerns.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative,
if you'd like to join us, could we meet in my office immediately after this? 10:15.
Sounds good. Appreciate everyone's help and cooperation in that. Anyone else from the public that would like to testify today on House Bill 2948? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. We're not going to work it, obviously, because of the work group has some work to do. So, Representative Dahlem, Monday will be our last opportunity.
Thank you for that opportunity.
I appreciate your volunteering to work on that.
And, Mr. Chair, I take it that means you're holding over the work session until Monday.
I am, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Just making sure I got it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And those who are... Let's see if we had anyone signed up for it first. Those who are here on House Bill 3509, I have one person signed up. We'll do the public hearing. I'm going to hold over work session on that one as well because of some problems. Bob, did you want to testify today or wait until we hold it over? Which is your preference? Either way works. Whatever. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3509. Ellen, would you please remind us what that bill is?
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3509 requires persons obtaining economic development assistance from the Economic and Community Development Department to verify that employees may lawfully work in the United States.
Thank you. Mr. Repine.
Chairman, committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Just a couple of brief comments, Mr. Chairman, on House, regarding House Bill 3509. I understand the intent that's portrayed in the amendments. Issues that were raised by my staff to me, now to you as committee members, are some clarification issues, quite frankly. As you review the amendments that are found on the second page, it leaves a lot of interpretation as to the roles and responsibilities of how we go about this. Now, granted, the bill suggests that we create rules and provisions to enact these sections, but our issues would be...
Bob, can I interrupt?
Yes, sir.
Please. You referenced amendments.
Oh, excuse me, not amendments. The second page of the bill itself.
I'm okay,
sorry.
Thank you.
Looking for the amendments.
Sorry. You had us all shuffling here.
Sorry about that. So we're starting on page line 5 of the second page of the bill, 3509.
Is that actually page 3, perhaps?
Well, you know, it's Friday. You're right, it is page 3. There you
okay.
go.
Now I know what we're talking about.
I'm used to
Mr. Repine, we're very used to this, not right. having the amendments or having the wrong amendments.
See, at my agency, we're required to print on both sides of the paper, so it's, on mine it isn't. So, so, as Mr. Chairman, committee members, as you see, the bill suggests, let me just cut down the chase of what the issues are with this. In our portfolio of a variety of assistances that we give either local communities or companies, we have everything from small grants, loans, special public works funds for infrastructure, sewer and water. So it crosses over both private sector and public sector. As you read the language in this bill, it causes some concerns or questions as how, first of all, how we go about pursuing this. Would we have to create actually a regulatory entity within my agency to be the people who would go out and either fine locations, fine people who might be considered people what be considered illegal? Would we respond to hotline calls if somebody suggests that there's an illegal person working in that regard? How would we go about the investigative process? Should we need subpoena power? There's a variety of things that rolls into the question of regarding how do you go about pursuing this and effectively coming to a conclusion. The other part that has some concern with this is, and I'll give it as a local jurisdiction, so it hopefully rings to all of you on the dais. If a city was working with us on a new water facility in their community, and they had, and it was say, a $10 million infrastructure loan with us, and there was subcontractors involved doing the work on behalf of the city, and you know, amongst those hundreds of workers who would be involved in that construction over the period of time, there might be an individual who would fit within this illegal status. Would it seem some unfair and unusual punishment to require that the city pay us back the money of which you couldn't get funds to do that activity anywhere else? And would it also be fair to assume that the city would be barred from any other economic involvements with the state of Oregon or my programs for other issues around health and safety of the community? And so those would be the issues that I think really, if we're going to do this, I think we need to talk about what are the ramifications and the responsibilities as we make those allegations or make those findings of facts. Could this cause us to go into litigation with our very partners that we would say, we think this person is illegal, therefore we are going to withdraw our funds? Would we get caught in a litigation with them on some precedents or some issue that would cause this to become much more cost intense than whatever the violation might have been vis-a-vis a person working in that status out of hundreds of individuals working on a project?
Questions, Representative Gerard.
Fine, Chairman. There is a national ID that's being proposed. Would that kind of eliminate some of the problems if we just required, like, the national ID if we went forward with that?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative, I am not familiar with what is proposed relative to the national ID of citizens or non-citizens. The issue will be is how do you facilitate and prompt that inquiry? How far do you follow it, and to what degree is the entity going to be off the hook or not off the hook that we're working with? I think that it could have some very chilling effects with some relationships we try to build within communities and businesses as we work with them to either improve their businesses in Oregon, grow their businesses, advance their economic infrastructures for their communities, or encourage other businesses to want to locate to Oregon. Could be a tremendous bureaucratic nightmare for us if overlaying all of the financial relationships we have with them and we say, oh, by the way, we will be the regulatory eyes on whether or not you have legal or illegal workers working with you.
Representative Dahl.
Yep. Well, when a community gets a economic development block grant, they have to create so many jobs. We'll go out to John Day. There's a place on the forum that talks about the number of jobs they created with. If a company were to put the wrong number of jobs, or a city, or let's deviate from the norm drastically, lie to you, what do you do to them?
Currently, if we find that there was a large difference between what was projected by the jobs they were created using the infrastructure work versus what was recorded or reported to the employment division, we could and would have opportunities to claw back funds from them. Generally, what we do is sit down and do a negotiation with them to find out if, in fact, the number of jobs that they might have created were in excess of what they anticipated paying them. And so having maybe lesser jobs but better paying jobs was a fair trade-off as opposed to hitting the 20 jobs they assumed they were going to utilize during that loan period.
Couldn't that same sort of scenario be used if someone employed illegals? I mean, we seem to have a mechanism in place if the form is fraudulently or in error filled out. Couldn't we use that same sort of punitive action here?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative, I suspect you could. Again, far less challenging than terminating a loan or requiring them to give the money back and or cutting them off for 5 years. I don't think we have anything in any of our documents that would suggest that that level of punitive action would be given because of either invalid information or wrong information.
Thank you. Anyone else? Bob, would you be willing to work with myself and anyone else who may be interested to try and iron out a few of the details?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else who would like to testify today on House Bill 3509? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill and announce that the work session for that bill will also be carried over until Monday, giving Bob and myself an opportunity to talk. Next up is a public hearing on House Bill 3395. Open that to public hearing. And I'd like to call up first Michael Dale, please.
Ellen, while he's coming up, would you tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3395 prohibits the denial of unemployment insurance benefits to an otherwise eligible individual who has qualified for benefits on the basis of part-time work or who seeks suitable and comparable part-time work. You have dash one amendments in your folder, and you also have a fiscal analysis that was prepared on the original bill, but you don't have a fiscal analysis on the dash one amendment.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Michael. Good
morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Oregon law treats part-time people in a way that I think is probably an anachronism from another day, where you had a single head of a single worker in a family who had a family wage job that adequately supported that family, and anybody who was working part-time was probably just, it was for, you know, Christmas money or something like that. And so that part-time employees have always been treated as being sort of second-class citizens in the unemployment system. Basically, what it amounts to is that if you earn enough money, or it's not money, if you work enough hours to be qualified for unemployment working in a part-time job, you lose that job. Then in order to collect unemployment benefits, you have to be willing to say that you're available to seek work and accept work anytime, any place, any number of hours, up to full-time work. Now, when we had the presumption that people were working for Christmas money, that maybe made a certain amount of sense. But the realities of the economy have changed substantially since then, and part-time work has become something that's a necessary part of many families' household. People have family responsibilities, perhaps to care for an elder member of the family, a disabled member of the family, young children. There may be limits of the time that they're able to work. And it seems that the employer for the part-time worker is paying taxes into the system now for that part-time worker. The amount of benefits they get are triggered by the amount of wages they've earned. So if they've only been working part-time, to a significant degree, that's going to be affected in the amount of benefits they get. The taxes are paid. Given the realities of today's economy, this bill would correct the situation so that basically it would say someone would not be disqualified, at least so long as they were seeking work the same number of hours and on the same schedule as they had been working during the time they were earning the benefits. That's the first provision of the bill. The second set of provisions of the bill deal with a problem that arises for temporary workers. Again, temporary work is becoming a more and more common reality of life, not as just some pickup work at during school vacations, but as a necessity as employers have moved away from permanent, stable, full-time jobs with a pension and a gold watch at the end of 40 years to a pattern of employment that uses workers only when needed, only as few as needed, as few hours as needed. And more people find themselves having to rely on temporary work for employment. But you can fall into a black hole inadvertently by seeking and accepting temporary employment. And the way this works is it happens in a couple ways. If you're going along and you're working and the factory closes and moves out of town, you're looking for work but you can't find anything, the rent's coming due, you figure any work's better than no work at all until you take a temp job. That temp job then ends. Typically the temp agency will say, report down here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning for reassignment. And you say, well, am I going to have a job? Do you have something for me? Well, I can't really say whether you have a job or not, but come on down. We'll see. We'll try to send you out. This is an advantage to the temp agency because they have a stable of workers that they're ready to dispatch. But unfortunately, it interferes with the individual's ability to look for and seek other more stable, longer-term employment. If the person doesn't come down and report, then typically the temp agency may report the employee as a voluntary quit. Well, it really isn't a voluntary quit because there's no job to quit from. The job is ended, and there's no offer of continuing employment. But nonetheless, workers and advocates report that people are being disqualified on that basis. The other way it happens is that under the unemployment laws, basically, the idea is you're not required to seek, or you're not required to accept any job at all. You're only required to accept suitable work. Now, what is suitable work? Well, suitable work, you look at the work you've been doing, you look at your skill and training, you look at how long you've been employed, or how long you've been unemployed, rather, and you look at the likelihood in the market you're going to find similar employment. And it's kind of a balancing test that the employment department does. And it's a frankly a judgment call. But if you've been laid off from temporary employment, now all of a sudden, if you look back at what your job experience is, apparently temp work is suitable work. And so if you refuse to take a temp job because you think you can find a permanent job, then you may be disqualified for refusing to accept suitable work. What the bill does is it doesn't absolutely mandate that you can refuse temp work, but it does set a policy for the state of Oregon that the pursuit of permanent stable employment is an important consideration and directs the Department of Employment in exercising its discretion to determine what is suitable work or not to consider the likelihood that the person could find permanent work weigh that in the balance in terms of deciding whether a particular job is suitable or not. In the interest of saving time with that, I would only say that there are -1 amendments. They were developed in consultation with the Employment Department to make the bill more workable from their standpoint. My understanding is that the Department of Employment is happy with that, but they are here and will speak for themselves. We're in complete agreement with the -1 amendments.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Dale? Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you. It seems to me there's a fine line between the temporary work and part-time jobs. Can you just clarify a little bit more? And how long part-time has to work to get the workers' comp? No, I'm sorry, the unemployment insurance. As I read that bill, I don't see any clear line on that.
The line would be set in current law. As current law stands, there's a base period, and the base period is the first four of the last five complete calendar quarters. It's a little bit confusing, but basically you're looking back at a period of time, and you have to work a certain number of hours within that period of time to be qualified under any circumstance for unemployment. You still have to meet that standard. And you would have had to work more if you're working part-time than full-time. You'd have to work more weeks, obviously, but you'd have to meet the same number of hour requirements as is in existing law.
Okay, one more.
Please.
I'm sure many of you might remember, if you are old enough, I'm sure you are, early 80s, in the late 70s, there has been a big problem on the I'm talking about more the workers' comp and maybe some unemployment insurance that they're continually draining more money out of it eventually, and then workers' comp unemployment insurance is high, and so I hope we don't get into that situation. And even though it's, as I read the bill, the amount is not that big. Currently, we have some excess amount of money available. But I'm just making a comment. We need to be careful because little by little, eventually, we are going to increase the point we cannot afford anymore.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, the unemployment system works in a little different way than workers' comp did when we worked ourselves into that situation. The rates for employers under the system are based upon really two things. They're based upon the overall status of the Employment Trust Fund, which, I mean, this isn't general fund money. This is special money that's set aside for this. And also upon the individual experience of the particular business in terms of how much unemployment they've had. Now, it's not dollar for dollar, but the basic idea is that if you churn your workforce causing lots of unemployment, you're going to have a higher rate than an employer who keeps people on at a steady rate. And so it would be a self-correcting problem if there were an overall effect on the Employment Trust Fund. I don't anticipate this will be a huge number of workers because most workers want to and do work full-time. But for those whose family situations does not permit them to work full-time, then it is an inequity in the current law because, after all, their employers are paying taxes now into the trust fund based upon the wages that they are earning. They're contributing to this system. They would only draw a proportional amount of what a full-time employee would because their benefits are based upon what their earnings had been. So it seems to me that the committee could find some comfort in there being a reasonable balance on that and not overburdening the trust fund.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I don't. Is there a subsequent referral?
Representative Dahlem, we do not have a subsequent on this, and I was just writing a note to pass down the line here that it. I feel that it may be appropriate. Anyone else? I'm not seeing anyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to do a work session on this?
Yeah, we have a couple other. I'd like to hear from the department, too, Representative Dahlem. They may be able to shed a little light that would help on some decisions here. Tom Byerly, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. I'm here on House Bill 3395. First of all, I'd like to state that the Employment Department is neutral on this bill. I did work with Mr. Dale on the amendments. I'd also like to clarify the situation with temporary workers. This amendment, this Dash 1 amendment, basically reflects how we are now operating. We changed our administrative rule about 2 years ago to reach this, and I explained that to Mr. Dale earlier when we were working the amendments. So when a temporary job ends, we consider the work has ended, and there is no continuing employer-employee relationship. As far as part-time workers, we estimate on this bill by allowing part-time workers to draw benefits, and we would want to put in an administrative rule that they would need to be willing to seek and accept work for the same number of hours that they qualify for benefits under. In other words, if they work 32 hours a week to qualify for their claim monetarily, we would require that they continue to be available for 32 hours a week to be eligible for benefits. And I believe Mr. Dale is comfortable with that requirement as well. We estimate a little over 9,000 more workers would be eligible for unemployment benefits under this provision. If that was a question that I thought that might be contemplated.
Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These 9,000 workers that would be eligible, do the employers of these people, do they pay into the system for the hours that these people work?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Riley, that'd be correct. All employers pay in on their workers up to a threshold of $29,000 of their annual wages. They pay a tax on that income.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
So if there are going to be 9,000 people approximately, and if we translate into dollar amount, how much is going to be?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, since the Dash 1 amendments came out, I would be more comfortable going back and recalculating the actual fiscal, and because the amendments are somewhat different than the original bill, so I wouldn't be comfortable giving a number right now. I apologize. We just got these about 4:15 last night. So I would like a little bit of time to to prepare an updated fiscal, if that'd be possible.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
If I understand the amendments on the bill, the amendments actually narrow the number of people who would be eligible, don't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that's correct. Yes, I think my 9,000 estimate might be a little bit high. That was based on the original bill.
I mean, changing or to and all by itself will reduce the number somewhat, won't it?
Potentially, that's correct, yes.
Thank you. So, if I may, Mr. Chair, my assumption would be, and I'd like you to understand if you would agree with this, that the fiscal is likely to be smaller, have a smaller effect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think that's true, yes.
Thank you.
That's my opinion. I'd like to get a better handle on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Tom. I listed four issues as the bill was originally presented, and it sounds like you're about ready to get a handle on three of them if you get a little more time. The other one I want to pursue just a tad is if this person that is doing part-time work, I'm going to make them a bus driver. And they're unemployed now, and they come into the office, and they take temporary work to fill up the hours. Is that temporary situation taken care of where a worker doesn't fall into a hole where they have to queue up for work that may or may not come?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, in our administrative rule, when you accept temporary work, and we encourage accepting temporary work, because you can actually take temporary work or part-time work, and if you're earning under your weekly benefit amount, you can still get part of your unemployment insurance benefits along with that part-time work. And should you take temporary work, our administrative rules do not require you to accept temporary work that may or may not interfere, I should say may interfere with returning to your full-time work. Let's say you were, you're in a food packing situation, and you knew you were going to be called back to work in a week, and a temporary job offer was made that lasted 4 weeks. We wouldn't require you to accept that 4-week job because we knew you would be going back to your regular employer. Am I making any sense?
Very, very clear, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you. can you tell me, because I keep hearing that, you know, this is what you do now, your administrative rule, can you tell me what piece of this bill would cause you to do something different and what that would be than what your administrative rules currently
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Riley, I certainly can. It is in Section 1 of the bill, the new subsection C, bolded language. Benefits may not be denied to an otherwise eligible individual who has qualified for benefits on the basis of part-time work and who seeks. Right now, Mr. Dale's testimony was correct. We do require to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits that you be available for part-time and full-time work, irrespective of the fact that you may have qualified by only working part-time. Let me see. So this provision that I just quoted is new to us. The temporary work provision that he's adding to 57176 is basically putting in statute what we're doing now by administrative rule.
Follow up, please.
Please.
So the only new thing would be if someone is working, qualifies for unemployment insurance under part-time work, they would be required to take a full-time position if that came up.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Ryan, that's the requirement now. If this was the change, if they qualified, except they would not have to take full-time work.
And that's the only difference.
Correct.
Thank you.
But that is also the issue that you were describing earlier, Tom, that it would seem appropriate then to require anyone who was drawing benefits to be seeking an equivalent number of hours of work equivalent to the benefits that they were receiving.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to follow up a little bit with what Representative Lim was saying, and I just need some assurances. Does this have the potential to raise the unemployment insurance the way it sits right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, could you clarify a little bit, raise unemployment insurance, do you mean the amount of benefits or the
amount? No, I mean the amount that amount would have to be charged and so that the benefits would...
The taxes would go up?
That's right.
The fiscal for this would be low enough that it would not impact employer tax rates. It wouldn't even come close.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The part-time workers or even the temporaries, do you believe this will wash out what they are paying in for the unemployment taxes and the benefit they are taking out? How do you see that? Do you think it will be the balance out or taking more benefit out?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, that's a really good question that I'd like to maybe do some more calculations on. I'm sorry I don't have an answer for you right now.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one more follow-up questions.
Please.
And Representative Barnard mentioned this new, the dash, I think it's dash one amendment, is smaller than the original the bill. What does it mean? What does it mean, smaller compared to what?
Smaller, I'm sorry?
Yes. The smaller effects on the unemployment insurance?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim. What I intended to say was the number of individuals that would have qualified for benefits is probably going to be lower with the amendments than it would have been under the original bill.
Okay.
So the total number that would come in that weren't before would be lower under the amendments.
Okay.
That's what I meant by smaller.
So my question is that, Mr. Chair, follow up. Smaller means that there should be a higher number. What's the higher? You mentioned 9,000 with the amendment, and if not, then what's the number?
Mr. Whitt, Vice Chair Lim, the 9,000 was under the original language of the bill. The amendment would be less than 9,000, a number I don't have yet.
Okay. Just one more question. You stated you are staying neutral on this issue. Can you explain why you are neutral? Because I'd like to hear this is a good bill, we support it, this is not a good bill, your intention, you have some reservation on this bill, so that's why you are staying neutral.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim, I don't have any position on this bill because, frankly, if I could be really blunt, I think it's a public policy question that that the legislature should be able to decide, irrespective of my opinion.
Thank you very much. That's clear enough.
It's the best answer I've heard all session.
Great.
We'll replay that one.
That's why we vote for you guys.
Okay.
Vice Chair Riley.
Just a comment. I really like Representative Girard's question. I wish I'd thought of it. And the answer makes me more comfortable with this bill. I think this is a good bill.
Yeah, that was my thoughts exactly, Vice Chair Riley. Thank you, Representative Girard.
Representative Dolan, did you have something?
No, other than to the Department of Employment always does an outstanding job. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You're very appreciative. Tom, if we, Monday's deadline for us, would that be enough time for you to review this and come back with the few facts and figures that would clarify the public record before we would do anything on this bill?
Chairman, absolutely, we could do it by Monday.
Okay. Certainly appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Before we go on, I have an important guest back over there. May I introduce you?
Yes, please recognize our guest.
And Mr. Kwan, the Consul General from Seattle, just got in the back seat. And welcome and appreciate it. Next is Mr. You from the Korean Central Daily. You have seen him a couple times before.
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Welcome to both of you. Next witness that we have, in fact, the last one that I have signed up, is Steve Lanning. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I just want to show our support for the whole idea of extending unemployment insurance benefits to part-time folks. We're in support of this bill. And I was really glad the question came up about employer tax rates, because that's always an issue in this body of what the bill would do to employer tax rates. And I was glad to hear that it would not affect employer tax rates by itself and raise them. So we think that given the nature of today's changing workforce and economy, this makes sense. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify today on House Bill 3395? Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Tressel with AOI. And I just have a couple of comments on 3395. I appreciate the Employment Department's position that this bill by itself would probably not increase UI tax rates, because that's a major concern. But I would also like to remind you that there are several other bills dealing with UI, and so in totality, it might be helpful to prioritize them or look at them all together, and I know that some of them are in different committees too. The other issue is, and I'm sure it would probably be done by rule, but what about part-timers that work multiple jobs, which Chair Witt, you and I have addressed that issue with workers' compensation before. You have the same issue with unemployment, where there's certain groups of workers that work part-time for several different employers, and how the UI benefits are paid when they're still working for maybe two of the other employers, but one of them they're not working for currently. So that was just something I'd like to have you consider.
Thank you very much. Questions? I'm not seeing any. Lisa, you have an advantage on me because you know considerably more about UI than I do. Workers' comp, we can have an intelligent discussion, but I'm at a disadvantage here. So, but would it not be true that each of the employers would be making contributions nevertheless to the fund?
That's right, up into the certain amount. And I think that he said the cap was $29,000. And that's another thing that Oregon is we have the four tax tables. We do a forward funding. We're pretty responsible about how we fund unemployment insurance so that you don't have a huge tax hike during a recession. The goal is to be at level four. And the thing that makes Oregon somewhat unique is that we pay on a higher level. We don't have a statutory max that says we're only going to pay this percentage of tax on the first $10,000 worth of earnings. You know, we have an escalator. It varies. I don't know what it's tied to. It's not huge increases every year, but there's slight increase on what you pay, and we're up to $29,000. In a lot of states, our members that are multi-state operations, occasionally they'll come in and they'll say, "Whoo, we pay a lot more in Oregon because we pay it on a higher amount of wages." But the good thing, we can tell them, "Well, yeah, but when we hit the recession, your rates really went up in Texas, but they didn't do it here."
Uh-huh.
So that's a trade-off, and we're not suggesting changing that. But it is something that you need to consider when you're looking at programs, too.
And I believe we were, I'm running on memory here, so this is dangerous, but I believe during the last recession, which was substantial, that we were, if not the only state, one of literally a couple because of the recession, the draw on benefits was going up, but we were like one of the only or a few whose tax rate did not go up.
I think that's correct. I'm not familiar with the other states, but I do know that we were able to, during the special session, or I should say the not-so-special sessions, the first one, and I think that we did it again, AOI and AFL-CIO worked together to do an extension on UI benefits that didn't increase the tax rates because of the way that we forward fund the trust fund.
Well, and I... Lisa, while I have the opportunity here, I want to recognize the job, the very good job that all of you who are on the advisory committee and do the oversight of that trust fund, the absolutely excellent job that you have done
continue to do in all of the time and effort that you volunteer to make sure that the funds in our trust fund are sacrosanct, yeah. And that we have one of the best programs in the entire United States.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm relatively certain, in fact, I'm certain that we were the only state that didn't have a rise in unemployment insurance rates during the recession. And, in fact, if my memory serves me correct, last session we reduced rates. And I think...
Right.
Yes. Representative Lim, who was chair of the committee that I sat on last session, will remember that as well. We actually reduced the unemployment rates in the state last mm-hmm. session.
That's right. That's right, we did. $220 million.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I was going to mention the same thing Vice Chair was going to say. And then could you give me the information how much reserve we have, and then also how much that the currently the total money available?
Well, I can ask my friends at the Employment Department. They do the measure, I think, in August, is what we call the dipstick. So they would have that. I'm a people person, not a numbers person.
Thank you.
The cavalry's arriving.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lim. I need to thank Lisa because... Well, I'm here under the hot lights. She remembers things that I probably should have said while I was here. Lisa does do a tremendous job on our advisory committee. I appreciate you recognizing that.
Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, again, Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. Thank you. Our current reserve in our Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is a little over $1.8 billion. So, and we are on tax schedule 3 right now. So we are actually below where we were recently, and last session House Bill 2127 helped us reduce taxes, and in fact I still have a quote on my whiteboard from Chair Witt how Oregon understands how to manage its unemployment insurance system. Got that out of the way going in.
Well deserved too. You all do a heck of a job. I mean,
thank you.
First class, best in the nation, and you need to be recognized for the good job that you're doing.
Thank you.
But it's the support from people like Lisa that help us do it, though.
Absolutely, there is no question about that. And I don't think the public realizes the amount of time that folks like Lisa and the rest of the advisory committee put in month after month after month to make sure. That fund is stable, that the funds are there that when we need it for workers, and that our employers are able to operate in Oregon's economy on a competitive basis. We're able to keep both parties absolutely happy, and we've got a good thing going here in this state.
Great. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify on House Bill 3395? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing. And committee members, I'm going to, and public, I'm going to hold over the work session until Monday to give the department time to come back with that additional information. Next, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3396. And we have up again Michael Dale, please.
I got two of those.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Again.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman Witt and members of the committee. My name is Michael Dale. I work with the Northwest Worker Justice Project, and we're the primary originators of this bill as well. This bill addresses the structural problem that we're facing as a nation, where increasingly our workers are in the situation of competing for jobs with workers all over the world who... with the increases in the mobility.
This is not for the audience. Earthquake drills up covered holes. What do you all do?
I have no idea.
I have no idea.
Jump under the thing.
Hold on.
Can I get a bigger desk?
Does anybody get a camera?
The two little legislators go right under here.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
we need to change the view.
All clear.
We lost Representative Barnhart in the fray.
I can't tell. If there were an earthquake, Rick, I'd have no trouble getting under there, but I'm not going to do it just for fun.
We can continue except for Barnhart, who's now dead.
Yeah, yes. He's dead.
The back half of me is gone.
Wow, just lost all the dignity right there.
And totally lost my train of concentration.
And
here I was on the road.
Right on the internet with the perfect drill.
What was your name again?
I don't remember.
Like something in the barnyard to concede.
All clear.
Restoring some sense of my demeanor. I was saying that we're basically in a situation where our workers are competing with the lowest paid, most desperate workers in the world. Increases in our capacities for transportation and technology really have thrown us into a situation where the idea that because you were an American and you lived in the United States, you'd have access to good work is really called into question. And as folks have looked at this around the country, the key for a good future is a trained workforce. The key for our economy is to have access to trained workers. And we represent people who are at the very margins and are most severely impacted by this. In our current unemployment situation, unless you're a trade adjustment affected worker that's recognized as being displaced by trade, if you're unemployed, you can try to take that time to get some more skills, but it's really discouraging for folks because at the same time, you have to hold yourself open and available for work, again, anytime in the schedule, full-time work. And so you're in a situation where you can go plunk down several hundred dollars at a time when you don't have very much money to try to get some welding skills or some computer repair skills or trainings long haul truck driver or something that's going to get you a little bit of a neck up. But if a temporary job comes up or even a permanent job that is a low paying job, you have to be willing to accept it and walk away from the school. If you don't do that, you lose your unemployment benefits. This bill is drafted. It came up in the rush of final bills at the very end, and I don't want to be overcritically. Legislative Council does a great job, but there was a real press at the end, and it came up actually doing a whole lot more than was the intent of the original bill. It changed the whole dislocated worker program, and it's been redrafted, again, working with the Employment Department to scale it back to what we originally intended, which was just simply this, to say, if you're a long-time temp worker, we say a year, if you've been working at temp work for a year, or you've been working at jobs that didn't pay more than 110% of the Oregon minimum wage, or you're unemployed and looking for work full-time, if those conditions exist and you're enrolled in training that within a reasonable period of time is going to create a reasonable expectation that you would be employed at a full-time job making more than 110% of the minimum wage, then you don't have to quit that training in order to continue your benefits. It's as simple as that. That's the point of the bill, and the point of the bill is to help not just the PhDs who certainly need help in gaining technological skills, but help the people at the very bottom of the market to develop skills that will allow them to compete in this very, very daunting economic market.
Thank you very, very much, Michael. Representative Dahl.
Michael, how does this bill square? We've spent a considerable amount of time on the governor's skill-up program. How does this square with that piece of legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, it is really quite compatible with that legislation. The principal difference is, as I understand the skill-up legislation, we're talking about actually funding the educational opportunities. Here we're talking about educational opportunities that are either self-funded or funded in some other way. We're not talking about the state paying for the training. We're just allowing people to continue to draw their benefits while they're engaged in the training.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That raises another question, and I'm trying to read the dash ones here quickly to see if I can find the answer myself. But this bill doesn't require that the worker be the person who pays for the training, does it? Or does it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it doesn't require that, although it permits it.
So, if I may, so that... It could be hand in glove with the skill-up program.
That's exactly what I meant when I said that it was compatible with.
Thank you. And if I may, Mr. Chair, just to comment on that, I hadn't realized that this was an issue, but it wouldn't make sense for the state to spend money on skill-up and then immediately require someone who's in the middle of the program to go to work at a job that's below what they could have gotten had they finished the program.
Yeah, precisely.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Anyone else?
Thank you very much.
Next, if I could, please have Tom Byerly come up again.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for the Employment Department. I'm in charge of unemployment insurance benefits. I'm here also to be neutral on the House Bill 3396, work very closely with Mr. Dale on the Dash 1 amendments. And basically what this does is it takes our current dislocated worker program that allows dislocated workers, as defined in the Workforce Investment Act, to participate in training while they draw unemployment insurance benefits, and we don't make them go out and look for work. They're to focus on their training so they can get a better job. This just extends that to the economically disadvantaged workers that are making less money.
Thank you very much. Before I take any questions or comments, Barry, would you call Representative McPherson's office and tell him he's on deck, please? Any questions or comments for Tom? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Anyone else from the public who would wish to testify on House Bill 3396? I'm not seeing any. I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. Committee members, we have a work session scheduled for this bill. What's your pleasure?
Is it ready to work?
I believe so.
Well,
yes. I haven't opened the works.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. No.
I'm just asking if there's...
Representative Gerard.
I don't have a subsequent on it, Representative Gerard, but I would certainly think that it would be appropriate.
To where?
Ways and Means.
Yeah.
And could we do that without the Speaker's approval?
We're going to I'd like to attempt it, and I may have it.
You win if you.
Yeah.
Well, if he wants it to go straight to the floor, then we'll discuss it there, won't we?
Right. All right, gentlemen, with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3396. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Barnhart moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3396. Discussion on the motion?
And if I may, Mr. Please. Chair, as I understand the Dash 1 amendments, they are a complete replacement for the bill. Having seen them, I didn't read the bill. I read the amendments, and they look fine.
Very good. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments?
Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Barnhart?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3396 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 3396 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion. I'm not seeing any on the question. Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Drott?
Aye.
Representative Bowlby?
He is excused.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. House Bill 3396, having received the necessary majority, is sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and a subsequent to Joint Ways and Means. I'm thinking we should... Is this automatically sent and it's not actually going to be heard on the floor?
I don't believe it's automatic. I can't imagine the Speaker won't do it because of the fiscal.
Mm-hmm.
But if he chose not to, you'd need a carrier.
In that event, we will assign Representative Riley.
And you know the motion to make.
Yes, he does. He knows it very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much, and I'll close the public, the work session on that bill.
It may need some protection in Ways and Means. I'll carry it down there.
And the chair may need some protection, too. It's a little unorthodox, but that's all right. All right.
I wonder what the next chair is going to do.
Barry, were you able to get a hold of Representative McPherson?
He's in committee right now. He said he got a note that he's supposed to come down here, but I wasn't able to talk to him.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to have to also hold over the work session on House Bill 3252 until Monday. And with that, why don't we stand at ease while we await Representative McPherson. Temporary recess.
You have two things left, I think, don't you?
I don't.
Or is it only one?
Of awarding contracts to video game retailers. You should have the Dash 1 amendments in your packets and also a fiscal statement that was prepared by the agency. The Dash 1 amendments simply expand the focus of the study. And as you may recall from the previous testimony, this bill is designed to address a recent Court of Appeals decision which invalidated an Oregon Lottery Commission rule that established a rate of return for the lottery contractors. And in that case, the Court of Appeals, I think its Director Penn testified that it was an impossible standard. And so the bill responds to that holding by the Court of Appeals. And then it also creates this study in order to help the Commission set rates that are consistent with the public purposes embodied in the Oregon Constitution, which is the change.
Thank you very much. Representative McPherson, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg McPherson, House District 38. And I think the committee administrator did a good job of summarizing the history of this. This is an outgrowth, as you may recall, of a Court of Appeals decision which held the process by which the lottery has been establishing the commission rates for retailers by rule as invalid because it had not done an analysis of the rate of return that was being received by those contractors. And that is not as broad in its impact because it happened to be that case involved a narrower group of the retailers who provide the hosting service for the terminals for our lottery machines. But the implications of it are pretty broad. That is that it would, under the language of Oregon statutes that exist now and which would be changed by Section 1 of the bill, it would be necessary to do what is in the nature of a rate-making kind of process, like what a public utility does, that is evaluating how much invested capital there is. And that that seems undesirable to go through that kind of process because there are other ways to determine whether we're paying the right amount for this important service. And one of those ways would be to do competitive bidding, which is what is called for in the study under Section 2 of the bill. But there may be other options as well, and that was input that the lottery agency brought forward, was to broaden the scope of that study so they could look at things other than specifically competitive bidding, although I think that's something they ought to take a look at as well. So I think that both pieces of the bill make sense, and that if the lottery agency is more comfortable having a little broader opportunity to for their analysis of how to make sure that we're getting the service we need to support the lottery at the lowest cost, that they should have that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Representative McPherson. Anyone have any questions?
Just one.
Yes, quickly. Representative Barnhart.
As I put these two documents together, the bill and the dash ones, it appears to me as though the statutory change that conforms the statute to the requirements of Section 4, Article 15 of the Constitution remains in the bill. And the new part simply changes the focus of the study. Have I understood it correctly?
Yes, and I don't actually have the dash ones in the original printed bill. A person from the lottery agency shared with me a typed engrossed version.
Right.
But the original printed bill made the change in Section 1
right.
Replaces the phrase consistent with providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors with purposes described in Section 4, Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution, that those are the purposes for which the lottery is proceeds go. And the specific cross-reference to the Constitution was a form and style matter that Legislative Council introduced. But that's in the original printed bill. And the effect of the dash ones is to expand the scope of the study that the lottery agency would do in response to comments that Director Penn gave you in the hearing earlier.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chair, it strikes me that the first change is a very appropriate one because it doesn't introduce extraneous material beyond what's in the Constitution, and it doesn't require that we restate what's in the Constitution. It just says you go there to see what the statute means. I really like that approach.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Additional questions or comments? Vice Chair Lim, please.
Thank you. And thank you very much for bringing this bill. Do you know any other state doing the competitive bidding, or is this the first ideas?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, maybe my strong Korean accent. And do you know any other states having the same that the way awarding the contract by competitive bidding system?
Very good. Chair Witt, Representative Lim, thank you for clarifying that question. My understanding, and this was input that I got from the staff of the lottery here in Oregon, is that there is one other state that does competitive bidding, although they do not have a side-by-side kind of situation with ours, because I believe it was West Virginia, if I recall, has a system where the running of the machines and the system is contracted out, and so they do competitive bidding with a full service provider rather than, as we do here in Oregon, that have the terminals owned by the state and then hosted by retail establishments.
Okay,
yes, Mr. Chairman.
And currently our system and operated under the commission and under lottery department, they are doing an excellent job. As a matter of fact, they are doing a too good job. That's one of the problems we have. Is there any that overriding that the issue we need to change of this current system?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I think there's a need to change the law because we have a vulnerability without changing our statutes. Under the decision of the Oregon Court of Appeals, it said that the lottery commission, the agency that oversees our lottery, had violated the statute, had not fulfilled their duty under the statute because they hadn't developed findings about what a reasonable rate of return would be to the contractors. So I think we have a vulnerability if we don't make a change in our statutes in that respect. The Section 2 of the bill, calling for a study, is a way of then making sure that we have another process that is going to do provide us with assurance that we're paying the right amount. And I want to agree with the reference that you made, Representative, to how well-run our lottery is. This is a very well-run agency and very well-run program of the state. People may have disagreement about whether we should be raising revenue for public services through this mechanism, but I think anybody who looks at seriously at how we run it would say it's being well run. It's generating a lot of return for important public purposes, and that's one reason why this is a study. It is not to require a change, because we want to make very sure before we start tampering with the way the lottery runs that we don't misstep and lose a significant stream of revenue that we rely on.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Representative.
Just one more. So I'm not getting it, I think. What you're doing with this bill is essentially maintaining the way in which the lottery is currently run while studying some new possibilities.
Exactly. Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, thank you. I wish I'd had your clarity of.
Well, I just figured out what you're trying to do.
It is exactly right. It is to Section 1 is to eliminate a legal problem, a risk that the state has in the way the lottery runs now, and Section 2 is to see what could we do better on an issue that is connected to what was stated in Section 1. Which is, are there other ways of going about this that would make sense? And competitive bidding would be one. There are others that the lottery agency has suggested as well that they would like to study at the same time. And I think that's a good idea. I think they ought to be looking at how to run their shop in the best way.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I just have more or less have a comment. I guess that I, for one, just think the lottery is run really well, and the competitive bidding idea, for me, is a real hard one to swallow because I come from a small community with small vendors, and the thought of somebody like Safeway or some bigger corporation coming in and taking the rights to lottery away from Hugo's Pizza in my hometown, that bothers me. And so I'll be a no vote on this.
Thank you, Representative Duran. Any further discussion? Representative Dahl?
Some clarification for me. The process is in adjudication in the courts right now. Has the appeals process run its course, or is the question still in litigation?
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem, the Court of Appeals case which invalidated the rate making process that the lottery agency was following. I can't tell you just where that procedurally that stands. That was a decision that was handed down by the Oregon Court of Appeals in December, so it's quite a recent decision. The time would have run by now for seeking review by the Oregon Supreme Court, which is something they have to decide they're going to take or not. And so whether that's happened, I can't tell you. But if you look at least, and this isn't an area of law that I practice in, but I have to say, having read that decision and saw what that Court of Appeals panel said, and it was a very strong panel of judges on the Court of Appeals that issued the decision, I think they decided the case correctly. There was not a record of having established evidence of what the rate of return was to lottery contractors.
Then the second part of the process, and in deference to the fact that I think there's concurrence on the panel and with yourself that the lottery does a good job, I'd like to ask representatives from the lottery if they are not in fact planning if the appeal goes to the Supreme Court or not. It would seem to me that they would be in the process of doing what the second step asks for, wouldn't they?
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem. Actually, I think that the study that's called for by Section 2 would not be sufficient to satisfy the statutory language that would be, if it were retained, the purpose consistent with providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors, because there's no, because the competitive bidding, for example, or the other techniques don't go to the question of what the return is to the contractor. And it really goes back to sort of the fundamental question here, which is that when the state purchases services or goods, should it be buying them at the lowest rate and relying on market forces to determine what the right amount to pay is, or should it be looking at, you know, what all the costs are and invested capital and so on for the provider, which is what we do in utility rate making, but we don't do that outside of monopoly settings, and this is not a monopoly setting.
Thank you very much.
Representative Riley, would you like to have the lottery come up?
I would like to hear their answer to that question, if we could.
Shall I stand by here to offer any?
That's probably the easiest way to handle it, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Committee, my name is Mary Lofton. I'm the Public Affairs Manager at the Oregon Lottery, and I will do my best to answer your questions. We are currently appealing the Court of Appeals report at the Superior Court level.
Supreme Court,
excuse me. And in regards to your question, if I can ask you, Representative Dahlem, to repeat it, I would appreciate that for clarity purposes.
Here's where I was going. When we have the lottery question in litigation,
mm-hmm.
and the good representative cleared this up very well for me, that it's a fundamental question of how we allocate lottery dollars. So my question to you is, and it would seem if what we're doing is in question, knowing the lottery people, you are in the process of planning right now.
Mm-hmm. We are. Chair and committee, Representative Dahlem, and also Representative Riley, we are reviewing the Court of Appeals, as I mentioned, but also, regardless of the outcome of this bill, we are going to undertake a review process. It is our guidance through the legislation and through the Constitution that we maximize our revenues. And so it is always good business for us to continue looking at ways to maximize our revenue. And the bidding process and the other opportunities that you'd see in Section 2, the alternative processes which would have to be determined, are ways for us to look at maximizing our revenue. Within the Court of Appeals ruling, that is really focused on 60 retailers that focus on video poker. Of all of our few thousand retailers that we have across the state. So it is a small constituent that we are looking at there. Currently, we have two different systems of paying commissions, and we want to continue looking at methods. If I may add, a question was raised to Mr. McPherson here that the I apologize, I've lost my train of thought. I'm a bit nervous. But the to which states compare to us? And we have put together a survey. You were correct in saying West Virginia was the one state within the country that has a bidding process. We are most similar, actually, to Canada. And in Canada, the provincial provinces there do own all of the equipment and run similar to us and put through their process there. So within the United States, we are fairly unique in the method in which we use. So as we look at our peers, we are always seeking to find the best methods in which to maximize our revenues, and this bill would allow us to do that. It is very broad. by broadening Section 2, that actually helps us find better revenues.
Follow up, and I probably have a two-part question and probably a two-part answer. So there is no preemption of the appeals process. That's not happening here.
No.
And would the bill help you with the study, or are you doing the study anyway?
We will do the study anyway. That is our plan. So Director Penn did mention that in a prior hearing, that this is, it's good business, and we would do that anyway. Section 1 is something that we would definitely like to have that adjustment made.
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Okay, and since you are here, when is, in case I'm talking about, if House Bill 2481 passed, the study issue, where the funding coming from? From their general fund or from their lottery fund?
It would be self-funded through the lottery's administrative costs. And there is a fiscal that was attached to the original bill.
So how much is the fiscal?
We have put it at, and if I could take a moment and pull it, I believe it was $40,000 was our estimate.
Okay, thank you. And then since you are here,
yes,
I'm just asking a question.
And actually, I was going to, if I could, Mr. Chair, I had stepped out of a committee meeting that I was chairing, and perhaps if there are going to be more questions, I would leave it to the wisdom of this committee to make a decision on this bill. And but if you had anything further for me, I could answer it now. Otherwise, I'd go back to my committee.
Anything further for Representative McPherson?
No. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Greg.
One more question. My question might not be directly related to this issue, but I just want to ask you a question concerning the dominant issue.
Dominant focus?
Yes. And how do you find out? Do you go out, check it out, or do you someone complain if you go check out? How do you work it out, that plan?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, we have put through a rule recently that changes dominant purpose, dominant use to a new version. And what it does is it is I apologize for not explaining this well going into it, but what we'll be looking at is their income rates. And when they hit a certain threshold, we are actually going to be reviewing the business model. For example, Sherry's and Elmer's have video lottery machines in their site. We can look at their sales for their site, take out the portion that is revenue from video, and compare it to their business model. If they cross over a 50% threshold, then we will actually look at a series of other factors, their marketing strategies, their menu options, those kinds of things. What that will then do is tell us whether or not it looks like, feels like, and is a casino. Quite honestly, that is a different issue than we have before us today.
Yes, I know. Certainly. Okay. Thank you.
Vice Chair Ryan.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring this up, but since the other Vice Chair brought this up, I went into a place in Hillsborough called Dolly's, I believe.
Dotties,
thank you. And basically it was a small casino with cigarettes. That was their only other business that I could see.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I asked them what their business was. Mm-hmm. And what they told me was that they have video poker machines and they have some other lottery things that they do. If while you're here playing the machines, you'd like a beer or some cigarettes, they have those as well. Is that a place that you're looking into?
It is.
Thank you.
If I may add, Chair Witt and Representative Riley, the Dotties organization recently changed ownership, and the new ownership is very supportive of increasing menu items and having their business model change a bit.
Because if they don't, they'll be out of business?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Mullen.
I want to make absolutely crystal clear that I that I understand. In order to maintain the status quo, we need the first part of this bill.
Correct.
The second part of the bill is come see, come saw. You're doing the study. It'll tell you to do the study. You'll do the study with or without it.
Correct.
Thank you.
Well,
yes, Representative Barnhart.
Just to follow up on that, and you're going to spend the money to do the study whether the bill passes or not.
That is the plan, yes.
Thank you.
Chair and Representative Barnhart.
This is...
That's just the question, right?
Yeah, that's the other, that was the last piece of the question.
All right. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Committee members, I have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. I do recognize that it appears that there is a allocation of $40,000 here. I've tested my luck once before this morning with the speaker. I'm inclined to think that if it goes any place, that it probably should go to Ways and Means. And we have a dash one amendment to this bill. What's your pleasure? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
Representative Barnhart moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2481. Discussion on that motion. I'm not seeing any. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? I'm not seeing any. It's adopted. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
I move the House Bill 2481 as amended be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 2481 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What I'm hearing that that a lot of it they are going to do either one way or another, and that we need this bill. It seems to me they are clear they're going to study it. Do we need this bill or not? I think that's the validity we need to.
Well, and I think Representative Barnhart may.
The answer to the question is yes. Representative McPherson, I think, made the matter very clear in his report on the litigation in the Wolf case. And as I heard him, he is convinced that the lottery is going to be forced to change their current approach to contracting because of the phrase in the current statute that requires providing a reasonable rate of return for contractors unless this bill passes. So what the bill actually does, when you get down to, when you parse away all the other things, what it actually does is maintain the admittedly excellent current practice of the Lottery Commission in its contracting and doesn't require the change. One objection that might be made to what I just said is that the matter is still in litigation. We've got an excellent lawyer's comment after reading the case in which he's convinced that the legal analysis in the Court of Appeals is accurate. And what that means, of course, is that he believes that it's very likely that the Supreme Court will uphold that decision if they decide to hear the case at all. And so the best way to handle this at this point, to maintain the status quo in terms of the actual practices of the lottery until the study results suggest that they do something different, is to pass the bill.
Yes, Representative.
Since we're going to annual sessions, why not wait and see what the outcome of the court case is? And if we were going to do that, why not just delete out the section 2 that they're going to do anyway, that they really don't need a statute to do. So, you know, that's my point of view, and that's why I can see both sides, and that's, I'm kind of a no, but I mean, I'm not locked in stone here, but I just think that if we're going to do this, then we should delete Section 2 anyway.
Well, if I may, this does go to Ways and Means. I would certainly have no objection to deleting Section 2.
But if you do Section 2, then you don't need to go to Ways and Means.
Well, the only problem is that we don't have an amendment to do that. And if we could do a conceptual amendment to just delete that second section, if we could get away with that, that would be certainly appropriate.
Committee members, I had this very discussion with Representative McPherson, and I think it is his preference that we vote on the bill as it is has been amended.
And I have no objection to that either, Mr. Chair. It doesn't hurt to put something in the statute that the commission plans to do anyway. It won't damage anything. What is important is that this change in Section 1 get made.
If I could, and
please, Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we do Section 1, we allow the Lottery Commission to maintain the status quo. Now comes the court and makes its decision. The Lottery Commission has two options now. It can follow the court decision or maintain the status quo, if we have the bill, because the bill protects the status quo from being overturned by the court, because it lines us up with what actual practice is now.
Makes the decision moot.
Yes, so they will have two options if we pass the bill. Or more.
Well, if I may, I don't really think that's true. It's possible. I mean, I don't know the case very well, but it's possible that the Lottery Commission might owe somebody some money under this bill, under the Wolf case, as it exists today, if in fact one of the things they asked for was money because the commission didn't follow the statute. But if we pass this bill, it cuts off any rights under that for the future, as of the time that the bill becomes effective, which would be 91 days after signing the die. So, I don't know enough about the lawsuit to know whether this is even possible, but if the bill passes, we do cut off any possible liability that the commission might have after the bill becomes effective.
Further discussion?
That's the problem, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be as means and have been sorted out.
We're going there. Mr. Chair?
I'm sensing a constitutional problem.
Will you hold us here until we get enough?
And if I knew how to get out of it, I would.
Mr. Chair, I think that there is a way to get out of this. The bill either goes up or goes down, and it's for me. And I heard Representative Barnhart's explanation, and I trust his judgment. I would vote this bill out of committee and down to Ways and Means in a minute, but I want to be sure that we're not delimiting with legislation the lottery's options. And I'm fairly certain we aren't. If I had that answer, I could go this bill up in a minute. And the work session on Monday would take us tap. And I would take this one on too and make sure that they come back and report to you it's good.
The problem I have right now, Representative Dahlin, is I'm in the middle of a motion.
Well, if you'd like, I'll withdraw the motion, and so you can keep the work session for Monday, if you'd like.
That would work. That would get me out of my existing
constitutional
problem.
Okay. I guess I didn't take the hint. May I withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair?
All right. Thank you.
With that, committee members, I'm going to hold over the work session.
Is it hold over or continue?
Carry over this work session to Representative Drug.
Close this out, but I do have a comment I'd like to make.
To Monday. Yes, Representative Gerard.
Chair Witt and the rest of the committee, I want you to know that that was a real eye-opener with the earthquake thing that we had here, and that was kind of startling for me, and it was a real eye-opener. The last thing I might see in my life is the very air of Representative Gerard.
That's on the record.
That would be an eye-closer for me.
That's called TMI, Representative Durant. Is there any further business to come before this committee today? Not seeing any. Ellen, would you give us a real quick rundown of what we're going to do on Monday's probably pretty long.
As the agenda is expanding.
Thank you, Chairman. I wish I could do it quickly, but unfortunately, we will end up having on Monday approximately 11 bills, I think. So we'll be having a work session on House Bill 2804, which creates a task force to study the methods and advantages of attracting the Olympic Winter Games to Oregon. House Bill 3181, which gives family child care providers the right to collectively bargain with the state of Oregon. House Bill 2981, which authorizes the Economic and Community Development Department to create a reserve fund for nonprofit organizations engaged in alternative lending. A public hearing and possible work session on House Joint Resolution 15, which encourages the governor to designate state ambassadors. House Bill 2759, which directs the Employment Department to use all unobligated monies in the Oregon's Jobs Plus Unemployment Wage Fund. And then the bills that were carried over from today, which are House Bill 2948, which talks about corporate income and excise taxes. House Bill 3509, which is the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department's assistance. We heard from today, verifying lawful employment. House Bill 3395 and 3396, dealing with unemployment insurance benefits. House Bill 3252, which is a unified report required to be published by the Department of Human Services, detailing public assistance provided by employed individuals or provided to employed individuals, and House Bill 2481, the lottery bill that we just heard from. And I would note that we will be in committee from 8 to 10 a.m. on Monday, April 30th, in Hearing Room C. And for those bills that we are not able to get to during that time, we will then recess and reconvene at 6 p.m. in Hearing Room D in order to complete the committee's business.
Sounds like Representative Lynn may not be the only one that's packing a sleeping bag around here. with that...
So we meet in the morning, and if we don't finish, we meet at 6 o'clock next door.
That is called an incentive.
That way, yeah.
With that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you very much.